In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello and welcome to Life of the Week from History Extra, where leading historians delve into the lives of history's most intriguing and significant figures. Mary Wollstonecraft was a firebrand thinker of the Enlightenment, proposing radical ideas about the fundamental rights of women. And her life was just as exciting as her work, taking in a front row seat at the French Revolution, a treasure hunt for stolen silver along the Norwegian coast, and courting scandal by giving birth outside of wedlock. In today's Life of the Week episode, Ellie Cawthorne spoke to Bea Rowlett, author of a book on Wollstonecraft called In Search of Mary, to find out more about her life and legacy.
Thank you so much for joining me, Bea. On today's Life of the Week episode, we're going to be delving into the life, work and legacy of Mary Wollstonecraft. So for anyone listening who maybe isn't familiar with that name, I wonder if you could start by just offering us a brief introduction to her. Who was she and why was she such a significant historical figure?
Mary Wollstonecraft is a massively significant historical figure. Very little known, but hopefully by the end of our conversation, people will have a much more rounded sense. But the headlines are she's one of the key Enlightenment philosophers of the 18th century. So she was an early architect of what we now call human rights. She was reaching for that language before it even existed. And we call her the foremother of feminism. Feminism, of course, developed in different ways all around the world. But for Western feminism, she's very much the leader in that ideology and was the first person in the English language to call for gender equality. And, you know, fun fact, Frankenstein's grandmother. I mean, where do you want me to start?
I mean, fantastic. I think that's given listeners a taster of what's to come. But I wonder if now we can basically flip right back to the very beginning. What do we know about Mary's early life and perhaps how it shaped her later thinking?
It was very shaping of her later thinking. So we know that her early life was wretched. People often wonder, was she middle class? Was she quite posh and privileged? Well, she was a writer, so she ended up with a platform. But the beginnings of her life were very unpromising. She was born into a family that was basically sliding down the social scale. So her father had inherited some wealth from his grandfather, who was a handkerchief maker. But that wealth was very rapidly squandered. She was born in Spitalfields in 1759. And they lived in a fairly nice house, but they became itinerant as her father tried to become a gentleman farmer, if you will. So as the Industrial Revolution was beginning, he kind of went in the opposite direction and sort of drank himself into an early grave. He was a violent man and he did not believe in educating girls. So Wollstonecraft's older brother, Ned, was given an education. Wollstonecraft was expected just to be quiet and to sit still and to shut up. And there are also instances of her writings sort of demonstrate that she tried to actually protect her mother from the violent attacks of her father. So she was exposed to multiple levels of deprivation and quite severe injustice. And you can tell because once she starts writing, all of that injustice just bubbles up inside her. And I've described it's like she goes off like a blender with the lid off. It just kind of bursts out of her as soon as she starts writing.
So how does she begin to escape this unhappy childhood and become the literary and philosophical figure that we know her as?
So she was, like all great autodidacts, a chippy, self-taught autodidact. She managed to sort of connect herself to families who had books. For a while, they lived in Beverley in Yorkshire, and there was a very formative connection that she made there, the Arden family, and they sort of took her under their literary wing, if you like. She expanded into their library. This was something that's continued. So she followed the Jane Austen route of the poor but worthy girl that can become a governess or a lady's companion. She did both of these jobs. But it was all by virtue of the fact that she'd managed to educate herself. She was denied an education, but she managed to educate herself. And you can see it in her writings because she's a real shapeshifter in her writing. What she can do is kind of absorb the way that the shouty men of the time argued. She absorbs that and she uses it like a weapon. So she's a great absorber and a weaponizer of current language. So, and I think that comes from the fact that she was a very raw, self-educated genius.
And I think it's quite significant the time frame that her life spans. So we're looking at the second half, really, of the 18th century here. What was going on at this time in terms of thinking and new ideas and radicalism?
Well, lots of radicalism. So once she'd managed to escape the wretched family background and set off and strike it on her own, it was her ambition to be financially independent. She fell in with a crowd of radical dissenters. So they lived in the area that's now Stoke Newington, North London. But radical dissenters were, of course, denied access to university careers or political representation because of their sort of more radical philosophies. To us nowadays, it doesn't sound that radical, the idea of enfranchisement, of people getting a vote, of political engagement, of women not being property. I mean, women at this time were like a kettle or a chair. They just had no rights whatsoever. You know, any status that you had would be lost at marriage. And if you weren't married, God help you if you had kids, because that could be used against you. I mean, it really was the worst. And it lands badly with the modern reader when you see Mary Wollstonecraft comparing marriage to slavery, because for obvious reasons, as a white woman. But at the time, women were scarcely more than objects in the eyes of the law. And that's something that she tackles right from the get-go with her writing. She's also, of course, by virtue of living in the radical dissenting community of Newington Green, falls in with the community of people that are very interested in the ideals of the French Revolution. So sort of late 1780s, early 1790s, this is all anybody's thinking about. And, you know, in William Wordsworth's, bliss it was in that dawn to be alive, to be young was very heaven. And of course she was young. And the sense was, the world is going to change. Everything's going to be different. How exciting. This is happening right next door. This is before all of the bloodshed. And what does Wollstonecraft do? She just goes off on her own to live in Paris, to be at the heart of the revolution and to experience it for herself.
So it sounds like a massively exciting time. As you say, in 1792, she travelled to Paris to basically become a front row observer of one of the most dramatic events in history, the French Revolution. Can you tell us a bit more about her experiences there?
It's unbelievably exciting to read about. Imagine, if you will, a primary school teacher just kind of rushing off to Syria or the Middle East or to Ukraine. She didn't really have contact. She didn't speak the language. She just rocks up. She had some reputation because by now she's published. She's known internationally as the author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which we'll come to. So she's not completely unknown. And she does have access to the salons of the time and to the sort of liberal thinkers of the time. And she meets them all, including Thomas Paine, who she already knew. So I'm always a bit torn because there's the philosophical legacy of Mary Wollstonecraft. And then alongside it and adjacent is this extraordinary, kind of insane blockbuster life. And the Paris chapter, the revolution, is just the epitome of just how crazy her life was. And part of me, well, initially when I first started writing about Wollstonecraft, I was quite defensive of that because that's what's worked against her, that she's always had this whiff of scandal and it's worked against her. And yet, the lived experience which fuels her writing and the energy and the passion for human rights and for equality is because she witnesses, like you said, she bears witness. And of course, the other thing that happens in Paris is that she falls in love and she becomes a single mom. She experiences sex. She's in the world. Before that, she'd been sort of a bit more distant and very judgmental of the world. And if you read both Vindications, you get a sense of that. Whereas now in Paris, she's very much in the thick of it. She slips in a patch of blood. You know, she's really there in the teeth of the Reign of Terror. Gorgeous historical footnote. She arrives in Paris in the week that William Wordsworth leaves because it's getting a bit scary. Fear's just not a problem for Wollstonecraft. She's utterly fearless.
Well, there's a lot.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
That you've mentioned there to pick up on. And we will return to some of those points about her personal life, I think, in a little bit. But just to stay on the point of the French Revolution for a moment, to me, it does sound terrifying. Did she have an entirely positive experience or was it a bit dicey?
It was not positive. It was not positive, but you have to set it against the context of her established writings, two Vindications. So she writes a Vindication of the Rights of Woman, that's 1792. But in 1790, she wrote a Vindication of the Rights of Men. She doesn't mean men, she means human beings. This is the blueprint for human rights, okay? And it's fully inspired by the ideals of the French Revolution. And it's also inspired by her local preacher, the Reverend Richard Price, who is, of course, a friend of the French Revolution and was one of the founding generation of the founders of the United States. So he was a key revolutionary figure. And we all know Edmund Burke and his huge attack on the ideals of the French Revolution. And Edmund Burke landed that on Richard Price and really roasted him. And this was Wollstonecraft's first kind of foray into print. She wrote a Vindication of the Rights of Men in defense of her great mentor, Richard Price. So it was not just in defense of the ideals of the French Revolution, but this person who embodied them in the English political landscape. So that's how she appears on the scene as a writer, as a philosophical thinker, as a political thinker in defense of these ideas. She goes on to develop them in A Vindication of the Rights of Woman and then goes to Paris, right? So her entire political history, legacy and network is bound up in the ideals of the French Revolution. So it is very hard for her when she witnesses the Reign of Terror. I mean, she would be deemed a spy. She's an English woman in Paris when the crowned heads of Europe are at war with France. So she's in hostile terrain, pregnant. I'm going to say barefoot and pregnant. She was incredibly poor. So this dodgy boyfriend that she hooks up with in Paris basically runs off with an actress and moves back to London. And she has to make it through one of the toughest winters. The Seine freezes over. This is 1794. And she's got a child and there's no bread in Paris and she's destitute. So, you know, she's up against violence, poverty, hostility, suspicion, and yet she still remains true to the ideals, even though by the end she's exhausted and kind of a bit disgusted with the behaviour of the French. And she writes, as you said, a first-hand account of the French Revolution. It's an extraordinary document. It made her effectively the first female war correspondent. And in it, she criticises the French a lot, but she holds up the ideals and she says there still is a revolution. And she then looks west and she says, this is a revolution that works. This is how you get rid of the oppressors. And she looks to the American Revolution, and that's where philosophically she was moving as she fell out of love with what was happening in the Reign of Terror.
So massive political turbulence, but at the same time, as you say, personal turbulence. You mentioned there a dodgy boyfriend and also the fact that she became what we would now call a single mum. Can you tell us about this relationship that she had in France and how it kind of chimed with the ideals that she'd put forward in her thinking?
So this is another extraordinary chapter of her life. So she goes to Paris and meets this guy, Gilbert Imlay, tall, sexy American frontiersman, well rugged. I mean, you can imagine he was probably a bit of a hottie and, you know, quite sort of liberal, you know, a liberal guy. And she massively falls for him. And Virginia Woolf is really good on this. Virginia Woolf calls these extracts of Wollstone's life her experiments in living. And she really was pushing the boundaries. She sort of, they were quote-unquote living in sin, weren't they? To Wollstonecraft, it was like a sort of a sacred relationship. She felt they were married in her faith. She just didn't believe in marriage as a legal institution. This also comes back to haunt her later. So he's dodgy from the get-go, right? He leaves her pregnant and, you know, the letters that she sends him are painful in the extreme. But, you know, as with Wollstonecraft, she's the queen of the bounce back and there's always a silver lining. What she gets from this horrible relationship is a brilliant piece of writing from the most improbable of circumstances. So, dodgy boyfriend, on the face of it, a frontiersman, a friend of the French Revolution, is actually a common smuggler. And he's doing some crusty old deals where he's smuggling shipments of silver from head-chopped aristocrats in Paris, and he's smuggling them out of France to the neutral states of Scandinavia, who still are trading. And one of his shipments of silver goes missing off the coast of Norway. At this point, they've broken up, right? And Wollstonecraft is a single mum, you know, on the streets of Paris having a really rough time. But he strings her along with the promise of a nice holiday and maybe getting back together if she can go and find his missing silver. And yes, the foremother of feminism buys it. She's like, okay, fine, I'll do it. It's kind of heartbreaking. But here's the bit that kills me. She takes the baby, right? So she goes off literally on a treasure hunt on the rocky shores of the Skagerrak, searching for missing silver with a baby in tow. And that historical nugget, once I discovered it, never ever left me. And it was the basis of my book, In Search of Mary. I actually retraced that part of her journey with my then 11-month-old baby, trying to wrestle with the scale of what she'd taken on and doing it with a baby. And no spoilers, but they never found the silver.
I mean, it's absolutely incredible to me that no one has made a massive prestige TV drama about this yet. We should say, I think, that the relationship with Gilbert Imlay was not the first relationship that Mary had had outside of wedlock. She'd also had a relationship with Henry Fuseli.
Yeah, very celebrated artist. You'll know his work. He's most commonly known for his work, The Nightmare, which has a sort of horrible devil crouching on a sexy woman's chest and a scary white-eyed horse peeping at him. He's a really weird guy. And according to legend, she proposed a ménage à trois with Fuseli and his wife, and this was met with some degree of hostility, not by Fuseli, but by his wife. Those letters sadly were destroyed by Wollstonecraft's only survivor, so we never really know the truth of that. But she was prone to fall massively in love with women as well. She fell massively in love with women as well, and she was intense, possessive, I would say probably borderline intolerable. You know, it's like, imagine getting 100 text messages in caps lock. That would be a relationship with Mary Wollstonecraft.
But I guess it's really interesting. Something I want to reiterate is that we're talking about the 18th century here. Like, how unusual was it for a woman to have these relationships outside of wedlock? How would that have been seen by society?
I mean, it's hard to imagine. Even the idea that she went visiting, that Wollstonecraft visited people without a chaperone is shocking. So it's really hard for us to sort of reframe the freedoms that we have now in contrast to how women's lives were set about with rules and discipline and disapproval and religion and hemmed in every which way. And she really did. I mean, Virginia Woolf is quite right to call it experiments in living. She tried to envisage freedoms for herself and she tried to live up to those ideals, and she paid the price.
I think that this is probably a good moment to talk in a bit more depth about her most famous work, which you've referred to a couple of times, A Vindication on the Rights of Women, which was published in 1792. So can you just tell us in a bit more depth, basically, the argument that she laid out in that and why it was so groundbreaking, shocking or significant?
Yes, I can. And this always gets a laugh. It has two arguments. And the first argument is this: women are human beings. I know, drum roll. But really, that was the level of the debate. That's where it was. So, you know, discussions around, are women capable of reason? Do women possess souls? I mean, the same went for, you know, anyone that wasn't a white male. The same went for, you know, other citizens of the world, black people, enslaved people around the world. You know, there was a sort of rigid ancien regime order of things which placed white men at the top, the king above that, and God above that. And, you know, Wollstonecraft looked at it and went, I don't accept this. And when I first started reading her, I noticed the word reason, and the capacity for reason and rational thought, that pops up all the time. It's a key concept in Enlightenment thought. And again, it's one of those things that doesn't seem that much to ask for the modern reader, that women are capable of reason, but it's hugely important. And what she's doing when she says women are human beings is she's saying, I'm proving it. I'm using my reason to criticize, to engage critically with an existing structure. QED, I'm showing you that women are capable of doing this. And then the second part, the follow-up point, so women are human beings, they're capable of reason. And the follow-up to that is, therefore, they must be educated. And that is how you achieve equality. And from the first writings all the way through, her entire body of work is predicated on the significance of education as a transformative power.
Wollstonecraft has been described by some people as a proto-feminist, by other people as a first-wave feminist, and even the mother of feminism. How would you describe her relationship to what we think of today as feminism?
I would say she's a feminist 100%, but then I'm a raging feminist, so I can't help myself. Of course I'm going to claim her. Why wouldn't I? Yes, the ur-feminist, the foremother of feminism. Of course the word didn't exist, but, you know, there she was. I mean, A Vindication opens with the words, I demand justice for one half of the human race. She goes on to be claimed 100 years later by the suffragist Millicent Fawcett as the leader in our battle. So she was advocating for women, agitating for political engagement, demanding education and a legal status, and indeed a sort of philosophical status, just the existence of women, well before other writers and thinkers. So absolutely that was a feminist thing to do. And I also think, you know, I take feminist in the widest possible sense to include human rights. I think, you know, as an early architect of human rights, there she was. She was a fiercely abolitionist as well. She was claiming rights for everyone.
A Vindication was definitely her most famous work, but as we've discussed, it wasn't her only writing. What are some of the other notable works that we should be aware of?
A nice, easy one, I'm not going to lie, Vindication of the Rights of Woman, it's not the easiest read. You know, we're talking very long 18th century sentences that never seem to end. And she tries to write a novel as well, but of course, novel was very much a nascent form at this time. The novel is interesting, Maria and the Wrongs of Woman. It sort of shows a political direction where she's actually thinking about social class as well as gender, as a barrier to people's existence in the political sphere. A good place to start is A Vindication of the Rights of Men, because it's written in a white-hot fury, and I love the story of how she wrote it. So, as I mentioned, Richard Price had been very savagely and publicly attacked by Edmund Burke, who I like to imagine as the kind of Boris Johnson of his day. You know, a big, booming, shouting, domineering fellow, very oratory, and, you know, used to winning a shouting match. And, you know, up pops this total nobody, Wollstonecraft, in the defence of her mentor. and sets out the case for human rights. I mean, but she does it at such speed, and she kind of lost her nerve halfway through writing it and went to her publisher, Joseph Johnson, who sort of nurtured quite a lot of the radical writers and was known for his amazing salons. He was an extraordinary influence in her life. And she said, I don't think I can do this. And he knew her quite well. So he went, don't worry, just give up then. And she went, right, okay. And, you know, threw herself back into it. She knocked it off in 6 weeks. Boom. And it landed before Tom Paine's defence of the ideals of the revolution. So she got it out there quickly. That's a brilliant read. It's short, it's concise. And when you read it, you're like, wow, this is super fresh. Also, it contains her voice. Like, there's all these asides where she goes, I must pause to smother my contempt. Like, she's just, her head's going to explode. She's so angry. And I love that. I love when her personality kind of bursts through. Like the Hulk, you know, she can't keep it in. But the best work of all is Letters from Norway. It's exquisite. It's an extraordinary piece of literature, really hard to categorize. You know, you've got your non-fiction, your political manifestos, you've got your novel. There's some like training manuals for how to raise children. Her first ever publication was Thoughts on the Education of Daughters. So you can see the direction of travel before she even gets going. But Letters from Norway is the collection of letters that she wrote on her return from this notorious trip, the treasure hunt, you know, crossing the seas of the Skagerrak, trying to locate the missing silver. And it's a series of letters addressed to Gilbert Imlay. She never mentions him, and she never mentions the true purpose of the trip. She doesn't say, oh, I'm on a treasure hunt, this silver's gone missing, but there's clues. And what she does give you along the way is this extraordinary travelogue / memoir / economic and political treatise of everything she sees. She's fantastically rude. She doesn't hold back. So she just jumps into boats, horse carriages, things that turn over, all the kinds of vehicles, just mixing with everybody, staying at inns, catching her way into people's houses, hijacking ships that aren't meant for passengers, and, you know, talking her way on, and just all with a baby as well, traveling in the most extraordinary way and lobbying all along the way as well, trying to make political contacts to ensure the return of the silver. And so what this produces is an absolutely unique piece of writing. I love it.
Well, I definitely have to go away and read that. So we've got her advocating for women's rights, human rights, abolition. But are there any more sides of her work that are perhaps a bit more difficult to grapple with today that maybe don't chime with modern sensibilities?
There's the odd sentence that places it very firmly in its era. So, yeah, I mean, some of it definitely sounds a bit racist. There's no two ways about it. She's, for example, she's very critical of the caste system in India, and she's critical of what she calls Mohammedans. You know, I mean, that's just sounds horrible to the modern ear. And then, you know, other parts sound unbelievably fresh about the way, particularly she's very trenchant on upper class women and sort of spoilt, privileged women. She's really, really hard on them, to the extent that, you know, she's been accused of misogyny because she really lets them have it. She absolutely hates aristocratic women. And she should know because she's worked among them. She worked for the richest family in Ireland. And so she got a load of material off that. It was like a sort of nanny kiss and tell that she did. She drew extensively on her own experiences. I mean, you could argue that everything she writes about inequality comes from what's happened to her in her life.
So I wonder if we can now return to charting her personal life. So we've left her, as you say, on this treasure hunt, carrying a small baby in search of lost silver belonging to Gilbert Imlay, this man who's left her. What happens next?
What happens next is encapsulated in the book, Letters from Norway, and you can chart the decline of her mental health. She starts quoting Hamlet. That's never a good idea. I don't want to make light of it. She actually attempts to take her own life. It's really awful. The mission fails. The relationship is completely over. She comes back empty-handed, and she does attempt, you know, she understands not only that their relationship is over, but she also finds along the way that his dealings, his smuggling, may be worse than she even suspected, that he may be smuggling weapons. So she just finds herself in a really dark place in the world and in her life. And she attempts to take her own life. And so this is really the lowest point that she reaches. She comes back to London, and then people are like, hold on a minute, you've got a baby, but you said you were married, but you're not married. So there's a whole scandal attached to that. And then this is where she begins to rebuild. And I've mentioned that Wollstonecraft is queen of the bounce back. She builds herself back up. She starts writing again. She builds out a life of her own and experiments in living where she is financially independent. She has a relationship. She meets a new person, anarchist philosopher William Godwin, and they decide to live in separate houses and try that out and see how that goes. And things start to go really well for her. And she's at the peak of her writing. And this is where she begins to write the novel, Maria. Interesting that all the characters are called Mary or Maria in her books. So she doesn't hold back in kind of putting herself into her writing, which I love. And this is the novel, very political, but it looks at women who are trapped in sex work. She interviews women who are washerwomen, and she goes into what was then called Bedlam, you know, Bethlehem, the then called a lunatic asylum, because women were allowed to be sort of locked up by their husbands. If they got bored of them, you could be thrown into one of these institutions. So she does some proper journalism around it and writes this novel, and it's unfinished when she dies. What you're seeing is that there's a much greater engagement, and also the idea that she's using different means to reach different audiences. When she first writes The Vindication, she's like, oh, novels, what a load of nonsense. But she's clearly decided, I can reach more people by doing it this way. Or maybe with storytelling, I can influence more people to think about people's lives in a different way.
So she's living this life, she's writing prolifically, and she develops this relationship, as you say, with William Godwin. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that relationship and how it ended in their marriage.
Yes, so that's the sort of shock twist, that they did get married, which no one expected, least of all them. But the relationship with Godwin is a wonderful relationship, and it makes me feel happy that she did have a partnership of equals, finally. She just found a decent person who got her. William Godwin was a huge admirer of her intellect. He thought she was brilliant. He wrote great tracts about her and supported her and understood her. But they got pregnant, and this is where I think there was a sort of a dip in the confidence of their experiment in living, as Wolf called it, that she gave in and married him. And you have to bear in mind that she's encountered firsthand the opprobrium that was heaped upon single mothers. She's returned from revolutionary Paris with this baby and no visible sign of a husband. So she's had to manage that. And she's also seen the responses to that child. That her firstborn child, the one that travels on this beautiful, dreamy trip around the coast of Norway, ends really badly. It was a huge taboo to be born out of wedlock or to have a child out of wedlock. And so they conformed with the sort of manacles of the time and got married. It's a tiny church right behind St. Pancras and King's Cross stations in London, if you're ever coming through. It's called the Old Church, and it's an extraordinary space, and it's where Wollstonecraft was married and then a few months later was buried.
So let's touch on her death now. She died very early age, just 38. Can you tell us about what happened?
It's shocking, really. I describe it as she died twice. It's, you know, it's beyond tragic. So she dies physically in childbirth, giving birth to the future author of Frankenstein. I mean, just, you know, you can explode your own head with theories about, you know, the myth of destroying your own creator. And there's a lot of Frankenstein wild theories to be read into that. So Wollstonecraft dies in childbirth. It takes 10 days. She's really fighting to live this time. So having attempted to take her own life now at the height of her powers, finally in a good place with good relationships and so much more writing to be done, she loses her life. And it's because doctors hadn't invented washing hands yet. She gives birth to future Mary Shelley, and sepsis is introduced because she has a retained placenta, and it takes 10 days to die. And William Godwin is there, and he keeps a detailed diary, and it is horrific. It's really upsetting. It's just really upsetting. She's trying to live. It still upsets me now. So that's bad enough. And if that wasn't bad enough, then her second death, which is the murdering of her reputation, because poor old Godwin, and he meant well, and I completely forgive him for it, but Godwin then, in a state of grief, writes the first biography of Mary Wollstonecraft. And he includes the details of visiting each other without a chaperone, of course, a child out of wedlock, the attempts on her life. And this just kind of unleashes a torrent of abuse. Poems are circulated about her naked body. It doesn't go on for months, it goes on for years. And this effectively is the annihilation of her as a presence, as a credible presence in the political pantheon. She's just associated with disgust and disgrace. the whole, you know, hyena in petticoats quote, all of this was associated with her behaviour. And this is what you would expect from someone who demanded rights for women. And, you know, of course, we were tipping at that point into the Victorian era. So things, and even the French Revolution had undone some of the gains that had been won for women. So the times were very much against that thinking. And effectively, it was 100 years of solitude for Wollstonecraft's reputation following her death.
And how did that desecration of her legacy affect her daughter? Obviously, she died only 10 days after Mary Shelley, as she would become, was born. So the pair didn't have a relationship. But can we kind of trace an impact that Mary Wollstonecraft had on her daughter's life in any way?
Very much so. I mean, Mary Shelley is an astonishing writer. I mean, a huge writer. She wrote the most successful novel of all time when she was a teenager. And, you know, let's not forget poor old Fanny, who's the first daughter, who just ends up with no parent because she'd come as Wollstonecraft's daughter to Gilbert Imlay, enters the equation with Godwin. And then Godwin and Wollstonecraft have future Mary Shelley. And then Godwin then goes on to marry and acquire another daughter who was Claire Claremont, who we know through her notorious relationship with Byron. So they were known as the Three Graces, these three daughters who were nominally connected to Mary Wollstonecraft. And it becomes a sort of gene pool nightmare where each of them, well, the first one, Fanny, takes her own life using laudanum in an anonymous Welsh hotel and is lost in a pauper's grave. That's the end of her. That's it. Just heartbreaking. Mary Shelley did live to an older age, but many of her children died. So on the travels that she went on, she and Percy attempted to a much lesser degree to live up to her mother's radical legacy. But, you know, I mentioned the sort of crushing nature of Victorian values, and that's what landed on them. So they fled and lived in Italy. And it's like a sort of caravan of misery, really, and of lost tiny baby lives. Only one child survives, Percy Jr., who ends up being the somewhat conservative thinker who burns his embarrassing grandmother's letters. So it's just deeply sad, really.
So after this period in which Wollstonecraft's legacy was really done dirty, as it were, how did it begin to be recovered and reevaluated?
So it's really interesting. It's been tracked by, there's a brilliant scholar called Eileen Hunt, who's tracked Wollstonecraft's representations around the world and found that she, you know, whilst she was associated very negatively here for a long time, she is still quoted in the US, which is more radically open-minded, also quoted in sort of independence movements in India and in Jamaica. So she makes headlines, and Vindication of the Rights of Woman stays in print around the world, and it continues its journey. And it's quite interesting to see where it lands up. She was initially quoted by the second president of the United States, John Adams, and his wife, in particular his wife, Abigail Adams. She of the "don't forget the ladies" quote in the drafting of the Constitution. But it takes a while. It takes a while. Genuinely, and certainly in the sort of British political landscape, it's not until the suffragette movement, and it's a suffragist. It's Millicent Fawcett who writes an introduction to a 100 years later publication, a later edition of Vindication of the Rights of Woman. And that's what puts it back on the map, really. And then, you know, of course, in the 1970s and what we call the second wave feminists, there's been increased interest. And I think that was about the time we also sort of dusted down the supposedly disgraceful details of her personal life and went, hold on a minute, this woman was a pioneer. We recognise her. We recognise her. We know her. Her life really speaks to us now.
What do you think of the commemoration of Wollstonecraft today? One thing that I wanted to get your take on was the recent controversial statue by Maggie Hambling that's unveiled in Newington Green in 2020. Some people loved it, some people did not feel the same. What did you make of it?
I've got to put my hands up and say I was part of the team that delivered it. So obviously, I love it. I mean, this was unveiled in lockdown and it caused a humongous backlash. So the artwork, And it's a sculpture. It's not a statue of, I have to be emphatic about this. This was one of the things that got lost in the furore. It's not a statue of Mary Wollstonecraft. It's a sculpture for Mary Wollstonecraft. And the intention of the artist, Maggie Hambling, was to represent the birth of a movement. So what you have is a sort of twisted and somewhat organic, silvery metallic shape with a defiant and small, fierce-looking image emerging from the top. It's quite curious. It's sort of anti-statuary in the sense that the Victorian obsession for having people in bonnets on pedestals looking triumphant and being individualist, it very much subverts that. Now, lots of people were very angry, A, saying how on earth can you portray the form of feminism naked? And B, you know, why wasn't it just representational? Why wasn't it just an ordinary statue like all the other statues? There aren't enough statues of women. And I think fair dues on both. I mean, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, and I didn't blame people for being upset. What I did blame is for the way the image was shared online, which was a cropped zoom in of just breasts and a pubic region, which I think was really unfair. And it was very, very unsisterly the way some people ganged up on us. Yeah, some people behaved quite strangely about it. And curiously, they were the people that had shown zero interest in memorialising Mary Wollstonecraft. I was like, I've been here for 10 years. Where were you before? Why did you care so much now and not like in the last 10 years when we've been knocking everywhere saying, let's have a memorial for Mary Wollstonecraft? Anyway, still occasionally get a bit of heat about it. But what increasingly I get is people sort of writing PhDs on it and engaging with it in different and curious ways. But I'm very happy to acknowledge that, you know, yes, there's definitely room for more statues, traditional statues of women. But Wollstonecraft wasn't a traditional woman. She was an iconoclast.
Well, it definitely brought her to, you know, the forefront of public debate, which we love to see. So how would you like us to remember Wollstonecraft today?
I think it's really important to remember somebody that attempted to connect us all. The fear and the terror of politics at the moment, it's sort of panic-inducing to look at the political landscape, and people feel alienated and people feel very stressed. What Wollstonecraft does is connect everyone with the widest common denominator, which is say we are all capable of reason. We can all be educated. It's a really calm message. I find that quite comforting. And also, if you think about the fact that she also lived through one of the greatest earthquakes that Western civilization has endured, that too is a bit reassuring. So I would take that message of human rights are for everybody. That's the common denominator. And then, of course, there's a wonderful quote that I like to end on when people get anxious about feminism and whether it means that, oh, do you hate men? It's taken from Vindication. And she says, I do not wish women to have power over men, but over themselves.
That was Bea Rowlett. Her book about following in Wollstonecraft's footsteps is In Search of Mary, the Mother of All Journeys, published by Alma Books in 2015.